morning, everyone. Let's dance here. Good morning, Dan. We will get this work session underway. Welcome. This is the second of four work sessions on possible amendments to the proposed comprehensive plan. I want to thank the members of the council for their time and commitment. We're down into the serious details now, and we're going to be there for a while yet because we, again, have a couple more work sessions coming. Appreciate the chance. I know a lot of you have had the opportunity to sit down with the DPS staff in depth and go through some of the issues that you have as possible amendments, and that's what we're about here today and in the next few weeks. I want to thank also a lot of volunteers, a lot of people in the community who keep participating in these meetings and giving us suggestions for how to get this right. So we are here today to work on several issues, starting with getting more in-depth on our centers and corridors portion of the plan. And I think with that, I'll turn it over to Susan and the team, and we'll get right into it.
Okay. Good morning. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And with me are Joe Zender, Eric Engstrom, and Deborah Stein, and Tom Armstrong. And I, like the mayor, I do want to thank you again for your and your staff's careful review of all the documents and maps. And we've all been having a lot of fun in your offices learning about all of the amendments and things that you want to do. As the mayor mentioned, this is the second of four sessions. The next two sessions are scheduled for February 23rd and March 1st. We've included the draft agendas for those meetings in your packet. I think they're on the second page of your packet. At the last meeting, you all pretty much agreed on what the agenda items should be for those meetings. The topics were selected based on the testimony that you have received and very specific requests from each of you. Again, the intent of these sessions, like all work sessions, is for you to get comfortable with the issues and also to begin the debate on some of the more difficult issues before we get to council meetings. At the council meetings, we will then ask you to vote on specific amendments that each of you have. Those amendments are becoming more and more clear as you have given dozens of them to Eric over the past couple of weeks, and after this meeting, we will post all of those on our website. And so the website is portlandoregon.gov/BPS. Similarly, we have given you all the bundles of testimony that you've received, either testimony at hearings, the emails, specific letters, and also all of the testimony on the MAP app. That also will is posted on our website so that people can actually look at all of the testimony that's been given on the comprehensive plan so far. So today we're going to cover three topics. They're all interrelated. One is the centers and corridors map. The second topic is the topic of mixed-use design. And then the overall concept and some ideas about what we began to talk about last time, the idea of middle housing, which gets a good laugh. And this was requested at the last meeting, so we will talk about that a little bit. And then at the end of the
meeting, could we please not call it middle housing? I think it really doesn't help people in the community understand what we're talking about. So whether we're talking about middle income housing, middle median price housing.
Middle density housing.
Middle density housing, see? So okay. I didn't even understand what we were talking about. So
good.
That would be really helpful. Thanks.
Okay. I think that's helpful. At the end of the meeting then today, as requested by Commissioner Saltzman, Joe will give you a brief update on the affordable housing bonus provisions, and that's both for the Central City Plan and the mixed-use zoning project that's going on. Finally, before we get started, we had sort of an aha moment because as we talk through each of these things, everything's interrelated and the different work that's going on simultaneously is sometimes getting mixed up. So while we're working on this, if you can think about every decision that you're making as being in one of five buckets, more or less, the first being that there's high-level policy, and that's a comprehensive plan. The second being the comprehensive land use map. The third being the list of capital projects, so that includes the TSP, the Transportation Systems Plan. And then, after that, there are implementing measures, and those are in the form of zoning code and the zoning map. So, comp plan, policies, comp plan map, capital projects. Yeah, that's right, including the TSP. And then zoning code and zoning map. You don't have the zoning code proposals in front of you right now. You do have the comp plan policies, the map, and the capital projects. The zoning code and zoning projects are working their way through the Planning and Sustainability Commission right now. We did that on purpose so that you can consider them right after you have the comprehensive plan adopted. So we just wanted to kind of delineate that. Remember that you're making the broad policy choices now, and that we'll be bringing the map and code right after.
Susan, to the extent you and your teammates believe that a proposal doesn't fit within the high-level policy guidance, will you be suggesting which of the other documents it really should be debated and inserted in?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I think that's different than just no. That's no but, and channeling to, you know, where the action is.
Sure.
And what do you mean by bringing the zoning code and map right after the comp plan? What does right after mean?
Are we going to bring them all as a package? We're going to do them.
The map and the zoning code are.
So this will get done hopefully in April or May. During the summer, they're working through the rest of both the Central City Plan and the mixed-use zoning, for example. Through the summer, it will go to the Planning Commission by the end of the summer, and then by November, December, come to you.
Thank you, Susan. I'm going to start going through the different topics, starting, as Susan mentioned, with the centers and corridors. I want to echo what Susan said, is that as we go through these, we're going to point out elements of testimony that relate to different stages. Some of the testimony is really about the code, and we'll try and draw those connections to you, but also try and keep the discussion focused on the policy that affects that code. But we will mention specific examples of code or zoning issues as we go through these situations. The first topic is about the map that is behind Commissioner Saltzman on the easel. That is the urban design framework portion of the plan. It's a part of the urban design policy chapter, and it sits as a layer above the comp plan map as an illustrative diagram to kind of communicate the direction of our growth intention. So it identifies different kinds of places through symbols and different types of lines and circles, and again, as a guide to how we prepared the map. And so we want to start at that level because that informs a lot of what else we do on the map underneath that. It has defined different types of centers and different types of corridors and greenways and different parts of the city, because Portland is not all the same spatially and how it's built. A number of questions came up in the testimony that relate to this diagram and the designations on there. So we'll go through four of the ones that got the most testimony. The purpose, again, of this diagram is to illustrate how we hope to grow, and that growth pattern is designed to increase equitable access to complete neighborhoods, a low-carbon community, and to local businesses. It also illustrates how we hope to be a connected city in terms of different greenways and transit corridors, and talks about how we integrate nature into the city in an illustrative way. So again, you have a couple choices, and this is the third page of your work session materials, and we have a box there that kind of illustrates some of the choices we hope to get through today. The urban design framework diagram is also in your packet as an attachment with it, and if we get discussion that goes to that depth behind it, there's a map that just shows the centers, and then there's also a map attached that has the corridors with their various definitions and descriptions. So does everyone have this page here that says topic one, centers and corridors? Okay. The first topic we wanted to talk about was related to what a neighborhood center is and the testimony that you received about Multnomah Village and their interest in not being designated a center. The choices we've laid out here are retaining that center designation unchanged, retaining it, but directing us to look at some zoning map issues as we come back with the zoning map. And then the third option is to actually remove the center designation. The center's designation is intended to convey the idea of it bringing us towards a complete community in the sense that we've defined it in the policy document as being allowing more Portlanders to walk and meet their daily needs close to their house. And we've distributed the constellation of neighborhood centers across the city in a way that gets us to an 80% of our future population living within walking distance of a neighborhood center. And that's one of the key reasons that staff has not recommended removing that center from the map at this point, is that we want to ensure that all parts of the city have that element of the growth strategy and can have a critical mass in a place that they can walk to and support that commercial vitality. So I'm going to stop talking for a minute and let you discuss that issue or ask questions.
So to me, it seems like there's two different issues. There's preserving the very... Multnomah Village is a different kind of center, and that you don't expect... I don't think we want the highest density right in the middle, but it would be very appropriate to have more density around the edges of the historic Main Street. So I support leaving it as a center. I'd be concerned in the zoning code part to make sure that basically the route of the Multnomah Day's parade continues to have that feel of the old village rather than becoming Hawthorne or Division.
And the option B that we've laid out essentially, I think, embodies what you just said, which is to keep the center designation on this high-level map, but to direct us to look at the fine-grained zoning pattern when we get to the zoning map. And to reiterate, the way that the comp plan map and the zoning map work is that the comp plan map gives it a designation of neighborhood mixed use, but within that designation, there's a variety of zones that are allowed to be placed in that kind of place, and ranging from the lowest density to the middle density. And so you could, we definitely can look at the sculpting, if you will, or the form at a more fine-grained scale at the zoning map.
So, I mean, this raises what's probably a naive question, but I was wondering, in terms of both Multnomah Village, but actually all the centers and corridors, I think that people are concerned about the idea that, well, if four-story buildings are allowed, it'll be wall-to-wall four-story buildings. If 10-story buildings are allowed, it'll be wall-to-wall 10-story buildings. And I would imagine that people would be reassured if we said, no, there's going to be no more than 5 10-story buildings in this area, or no more than 6 four-story buildings in this area, and the neighborhoods will be consulted as to where those might be. Is that just, you know, legally impossible to do anything like that?
Yes.
You essentially, in order to have a comprehensive plan and a zoning map, you have to designate where things are allowed, and we don't entirely have control over that unless you want to, you know, only spot zone 5 places in each neighborhood. But that's also tricky because you have to have a rational basis for picking which sites you picked. And so it's the closest we get to that is through follow-up neighborhood planning at a local level, where we can do more fine-grain adjustment to the zoning map, or through plan districts. And so I think embodied in the option B that Commissioner Fritz mentioned, that notion is applicable to other centers too, that the zoning map gives us a tool to vary the heights at different segments of the center. It doesn't all have to be the same zoning throughout the length of a corridor, and we have discussed options at the zoning map level for varying those heights along the length of a corridor according to either a local plan or according to how the zoning is already that way in some areas.
You know, the option B here gets to the outcome that you're talking about, which is that they're not, that we're metering the additional density that's created in those town centers, or this one in particular. But obviously there's still considerable property owner autonomy about when that happens on a particular site, but we're metering how much of it and how dense if we take that approach that they're suggesting here with option B.
Eric, just a philosophical question, and we're going to be hearing a lot more about Multnomah Village in the future, in part because if one of the two leading candidates for mayor is elected, four members of council will either live in Multnomah Village or be within a five-minute drive of Multnomah Village, which is somewhat unprecedented. The tension that I keep hearing is between preserving neighborhood character, and it has a unique character, the business district and the surrounding area, which is why I suspect so many people have chosen to move there or thinking about living there, and there's so many amenities, and also meeting these broader goals. So as a practical matter, if we choose option B, what are the steps that follow where people who live there have a chance to shape the overall vision?
The steps that would follow is behind this package of comp plan policies is a zoning map that is right now at the discussion draft stage, and we did collect a bunch of testimony on that, including from different neighborhoods. It will go through the Planning Commission, so there'll be another opportunity for folks to weigh in there. We have a general approach of after comp plan. Right now, for the last few years, we've been doing the citywide plan, which is a little bit unusual in our practice. We're normally doing local area plans or neighborhood plans or corridor plans, and so that is our normal practice. So after we review the zoning map, then typically we are going into a community, different communities locally based on, you know, the council has to prioritize where they want us to do local plans, of course, but at any given time, we're doing a couple of those at a fine-grained local scale, and there's more opportunity in that kind of planning practice for there to be local input than there is in these large citywide efforts.
And if I could add to that, a number of the topics today are going to lend themselves to that kind of follow-up approach, the middle-density housing, how it's actually implemented on the ground. We're looking for policy sort of direction today and the principles, but just like in Multnomah Village, just like in a lot of these places, you need there's benefits from taking a closer localized look. It's also more difficult because it gets pretty vested in the local interests to do that, but our follow-up work program is going to be, we've been thinking of them more as development strategies for especially these neighborhood centers. If you look at the map, the small orange circles, but these are the places that we need to see emerge over the next 20 years.
And the toolbox at that level is, again, we can change or modify zoning maps through a process like that. There are plan districts where you can write custom regulations for a particular area. Examples of that are Hollywood or St. John's have plan districts. We also have historic preservation district tools that could be applied. Some of those are limited by state law in terms of how many teeth they can have, but we have some of those tools. And for example, Mississippi Avenue in North Portland is a historic district, and so that's a tool that right now is not applied to Multnomah Village or all of the centers that are like that, but could be. And there's follow-up work that we're initiating on to expand our historic preservation program as well, and that will play into this. But the main thing among that being the updating our inventories.
Is there a policy statement that we value different neighborhoods having different characters and that not all neighborhood centers will be exactly the same?
There is, and I can follow up with which policy
that's
we
all
think.
I need to. So I think it's really important to me that since the zoning may look the same, there is some kind of an assurance, particularly in this particularly special place to me, because I grew up in Portland near there, that we retain the character there and make sure that we add density so that more people can enjoy it, but add it around the perimeter rather than on the main street.
Are we ready to move to the next?
Just one more comment, which is that I like option B, but I like it as exactly as you phrased it, to consider lower the zoning in some portions of the center. I'm not presuming, I mean, it could be that you come back with various options and I conclude actually just leave it the way it is. So I join in the request to consider without any prejudgment as to approval of anything in particular.
Based on testimony that we got from Southwest Neighborhoods, a number of them, about the status of Beaverton Hillsdale Highway on that diagram. And you can see on that map that it is right here. And it's a thick yellow line which designates a civic corridor. And a civic corridor is a designation that we gave a lot of our bigger boulevards, our former state highways, and there's a set of policies in the comp plan around transforming those places into more vibrant communities and kind of creating them as a focus of civic focus rather than a divider of neighborhoods. And so based on the size of Beaverton Hillsdale, we gave it a civic corridor designation. Some of the testimony pointed out, and I think legitimately, that Beaverton Hillsdale is a bit unique for a couple reasons. One is it has more of a nodal pattern, unlike Sandy or Barber, where there's a continuous mixed-use zoning. Beaverton Hillsdale has a very nodal, and the nodes are fairly small. The other thing that's unique is it follows a creek most of the distance, so it doesn't really have the opportunity for large-scale development on both sides of it, even if it were residential between the nodes. So staff is, I think, somewhat agrees with the testimony and is okay with the idea of B here, which would change it to a neighborhood corridor. The difference being that a civic corridor, you're eligible for the highest density mixed-use zones, the full range of mixed-use zones from the lower density CM1 to CM3. With a neighborhood corridor or center, you're not eligible for that higher designation of CM3. So it would be slightly smaller scale at those nodes if we designated as a neighborhood corridor, and that may be okay in this situation.
Is there a neighborhood center in Raleigh Hills?
Town center, actually, it's right outside Portland, but one of the nodes on the highway abuts that.
So if we went with the neighborhood center, does that still allow for higher density in places like Hillsdale? And
it does not affect Hillsdale because it's designated as a town center, regardless of the status of the line that goes through it.
So we're talking about Beaverton Hillsdale west of,
yes,
of Hillsdale?
Yeah, Hillsdale would, because it's got a circle identifying it as a town center, would still be eligible for the higher density CM3 if they chose it.
That section from Hillsdale Town Center to the city limits.
Nice. Right. And as you mentioned, there is a little bit of the town center that's right over the boundary on the other side in Washington County, and so, you know, that might enable some higher density right against the boundary there as part of that center, but otherwise the space between would be a lower density.
I thought about this after our earlier conversation about it. The only wild card factor here, I think changing it to civic corridor is fine. It's a significantly overbuilt roadway. If we were to have a more robust bus rapid transit network in the city, it's a place where you could take two lanes away from auto capacity, create a bus corridor of great quality, and not affect traffic operations very much, because it was one of the few places where we just built way too much roadway capacity back in the day. You can argue about 82nd, but it's pretty full most of the time. Beaverton Hillsdale, rarely so. Nevertheless, the zoning designations that are still allowed under civic corridor would allow quite a bit of infill and redevelopment, you know, at those intersections where there's big enough pieces of property to do something, even if it's called a civic corridor instead. I'm sorry, neighborhood corridor instead. So I think it's not a significant change to change the flavor of the corridor, especially since we have no idea when and if that notion of using it for higher capacity transit purposes could ever happen.
What would the difference mean for, say, Beaverton Hillsdale Shattuck Road, that intersection where you have an Albertsons? And it seems like it's an area that could be redeveloped some point over the next 20 years. And is it?
That's the node that's close to the town center designation in Washington County, so that probably would not constrain that particular intersection there because of its adjacency to the town center circle on the map here.
Well, I guess I'm talking about the opportunity to redevelop those areas into mixed.
The neighborhood corridor would still allow mixed use. It's just a question of scale. And so it allows a medium scale of up to four stories and potentially five with a bonus, but but as opposed to 6 or 7.
So, I mean, how many potential housing units would we be losing by making this change?
We haven't done that calculation. We certainly can. It's probably not significant given the zoning pattern that's there right now, that because of the creek and the location of the road and the topography, there's not a lot of opportunity for dense housing there anyway, outside of the town center circles that we've talked about. Okay, the next item was following up on some discussion, partly with the mayor, about the status of the Hayden Island Neighborhood Center. Early in the discussion with the Planning Commission, there was a neighborhood center circle on East Hayden Island to indicate the hope that may become more of an urban place in the future, and also based on the notion that there is a long-term plan. It was a long-term plan for high-capacity transit extension to that island. The Planning Commission, in light of the uncertainty around the extension of transit, backed off that and asked to remove that circle from the map, and the mayor has expressed interest in discussing that.
Yeah, this is one where I think if this is an aspirational long-term plan, we should put on paper what we aspire to, which is for that to be a real neighborhood connected either by a surface street to the existing transit station or by an extension to the existing transit line. But this is a long-term plan, and I think this has also got broad support by the neighborhood. I mean, this is what they want, as well as what I think as somebody who thinks about planning believes should be the case. So it's not that we would be imposing a future on Hayden Island that the neighborhood doesn't want, quite the contrary.
And staff has put in option B here, noted also that to pair that with an expression in the transportation system plan that there ought to be better local access to the island, and that could be expressed as an unconstrained project because we don't know where the money is coming from for that yet, but it should be more clearly expressed if we're gonna state that aspiration to have the neighborhood center there. So we've paired those recommendations and made a parallel recommendation to the transportation system plan.
I think regardless of when the Columbia River crossing gets fixed, we need an arterial bridge to East Hayden Island, and having the center there, it's got many of the elements of a neighborhood center anyway, so I definitely support the mayor's proposal, and I support putting that in the unconstrained list. Obviously, it's not something that we have the capacity to do as a high-priority bridge project by ourselves, but we should definitely have it on the aspirational list.
That decouples that decision, that we should have that project in the unconstrained list and the zoning pattern that we want, from the question of will there ever be a different interstate highway bridge.
Can you tell me, what is the unconstrained list
again? The transportation system plan has a broad list of desired transportation projects to support the plan, and it's divided into two categories. The first category is the constrained list, which is the list of projects that fits within our projected budget for the next 20 years, and then the unconstrained is the rest of the list that is not yet allocated or where we depend on other sources of money beyond what we've already thought about.
The list I have at home of all the home repairs that I can't afford, that's the unconstrained list.
Okay, correct. Okay,
it's going to be mentioned by BDS if I'm not careful.
The fourth item on this topic is, and this came in late in the process, but there was a request from NWDA to be changed from a town center to a neighborhood center, and the distinction between a town center and a neighborhood center, all other things being equal, is that a town center has a higher aspiration for just the intensity of its catchment in terms of retail. It's more of a serving an entire quadrant of the city with services as opposed to a cluster of neighborhoods. And there's also a difference in the expected amount of residential growth. Neighborhood center, the policy says something like 3,500 people or households within a walking distance immediately around it, whereas the town center has a policy statement of around 7,000 people, which is more of a regional draw. And so it's a density difference. As a matter of just existing fact, Northwest does have that population more akin to a town center. The other factor here, though, is that, and it's easier to show on this next map. This is just a map of the centers, and you can see it more clearly, but the shading in the middle represents the policy of what we call the inner ring in the policy document, and that's an illustration of the fact that the territory radiating out from the central city is a little bit different than the rest of the city in its orientation, because in a lot of those places you can literally walk to the central city, and other areas there very frequent transit service in many of those areas because of the way the different buses converge as they approach the bridges and enter the central city. So we've defined that as kind of a special place in our policy, and essentially said that those are going to be very urban districts regardless of whether they are centers or corridors. They still may have commercial corridors or commercial centers within them that are neighborhood centers or town centers, but the wider district is more of an urban scale. And so what that means is that whether there's a circle in Northwest, how big the circle in Northwest is a little bit less important in this case because of its proximity to the central city and the other policies we've already put in place. It may not, I guess what I'm saying is it may not make that much policy difference whether that circle is a neighborhood center or a town center. The main difference may be how Metro thinks of it in terms of regional policy and which regional policies apply, but within the local comp plan, we've written policies about that inner ring that look a lot like town center-like policies anyway.
A little bit, because I'm not sure if making that change, even though it's requested, I guess, by the neighborhood, might not be unhelpful to the neighborhood. So if you take the existing zoning pattern and the development that's already underway, for example, on the Conway properties, it's going to be way over the typical town center density. It already is. It's dense, one of the densest neighborhoods in the city, maybe now not the densest once we have the Pearl District, but one of the densest neighborhoods in the city. And there's quite a bit of development that's already entitled, either underway or allowed for. So if the difference between the nomenclature is their eligibility for transportation funding through Metro as a town center, the neighborhood might want that. So if this is mostly a difference of nomenclature, and I understand everybody, including people, some people in Northwest, are nervous about how much development's going to happen, nevertheless, it is happening. A lot of it has happened. I'm concerned that we might be, again, cutting off our opportunity for funding for projects if we change that designation there.
I just ask a clarifying question. Is it currently a town center on Metro's 2040 plan?
No. It's not currently a town center on Metro's map. It's kind of treated by Metro as a special case because of its unique level of density, but it's not formally a town center.
So would it need an amendment to the framework plan in order to make it one?
Yeah, all the places where we've got identifiers on this map that are not currently on the Metro map would require us to do a follow-up reconciliation with Metro, and we're expecting that. The other situation where that would occur is the Killingsworth Interstate proposal for a town center there and the Midway proposal. Neither of those are on the Metro map and would require us to go to them and ask for that in the future. And if this plan is adopted with those, we would do that.
I'm sure they'd be fine with that because we're essentially be saying we can take more in these places. We wouldn't be saying we're going to take less, and we could use that maybe for balancing of some of the other things.
I mean, there's a regional process, but generally Metro has not said no to that kind of request.
Eric, what? I guess I don't have enough information to support the change. I'd have to know more. But what would be the impact of this option B, 4B, on... let's say Montgomery Park or what would be the option on, what would be the impact on any of the industrial areas that are being either rezoned or targeted for development?
It probably primarily affects the mixed use and residential areas south of Vaughan in this case. There's separate metro policy constructs for the industrial and employment areas, so this is about how we think about this place in terms of residential growth. And its commercial role is the primary effect, as commercial being retail. And so it affects Conway, and it affects the main streets like 21st and 23rd and how we think of those. But even with or without a tent center, we have the ability to scale the zoning to different levels. And because it's close to the central city, the policy we've proposed in this comp plan is that we allow the full range of all the mixed-use zones that close to the central city, regardless of the town center or neighborhood center designation. If you're outside that inner ring, it would make more of a difference because the neighborhood center wouldn't allow that denser mixed use. But we've essentially said, as a matter of policy, we want all of the corridors close to the central city to have that option.
What does NWDA think the effect would be of making the change?
There's some testimony. You'd have to look at that, or you could ask them in the follow-up hearing we have. So you can hold this one and ask for more.
So what do you think the difference would be in terms of the zoning?
I don't think it would make any difference in what zones we might consider there. I think the mayor's right. It could affect how we think about it at a regional transportation level.
So is currently enough capacity in the zoning, or are you thinking of changes in the zoning that would increase the capacity even more?
We're not thinking of changes that are increasing it more. It's already got a tremendous amount of capacity, like in the Conway area in particular.
So I think somebody said earlier, it's already functioning, in essence, as a town center. It has the Conway redevelopment and others happening, and certainly I think a lot of the retail along Northwest 21st and 23rd consider themselves as retailers to a broader segment than those who simply live within a half mile. So, I mean, it seems like if it walks like a duck, it's the town center.
Mayor, just a question. What's the practical effect of the metro designation, and what transportation dollars are eligible? I mean, I was on Friday night in the heart of that district, and I was reminded that 23rd needs to be repaved at some point soon. And there's some other challenges. There's almost a failed intersection at rush hour when you come off the bridge. What dollars could you get from Metro with the town center designation for transportation? How would that alleviate some of the challenges here?
Steve may have a better handle on this than me, but let's say it was proposed to extend the streetcar from its current alignment into the Conway district, we would be not only trying to do that with local improvement district funds that we've typically used to build the streetcar, but we would also be applying for regional funds through JPAC. I think if it's a town center, it would rank higher. I think
that's true, but it's worth following up with and having that conversation with PBOT probably.
Quorum of I thinks. Well, let's check that out with PBOT and Metro, and then we can return to that question.
Yeah, just be interested in knowing what the content is.
Because, again, I think we've clarified here that the substantive effect is not that the zoning would be much different, if any. And so, therefore, the amount of growth and development that's possible is the same in either case. But it feels better to be a neighborhood center than town center because it feels like you might have less growth. Sorry, there's still going to be a lot. And I'm being flippant there, but that's the case. And then secondly, if we're actually cutting off our nose to spite our face and losing out on transportation money, it's a bad bargain. So let's figure that piece out.
So moving us on then to topic two.
As I mentioned before, this is focused on mixed-use design and form, and we got quite a bit of testimony on that topic. One of the items of testimony that seemed to attract a lot of interest was the Division Design Initiative's top 10 policy recommendations, which is a document that looks kind of like this. And you had a whole lot of different constituencies referring to that and referring to their support of that document, and so we thought it would be worth spending a little time today talking about how we've responded to that and where we are with different elements of it. So the top 10, the first two pages of the handout is what we got from them, and the final document that is a fold-out with two sides is for each of their 10 points we've gone through and itemized kind of how that relates to policy that's in the document right now and what's going on at the project level. A simpler version of that is in your attachment, which it might be simpler to just walk you through that, and if you want to look at the bigger document at your leisure, that might be easier. So all the 10 items are in the two pages of table on your, they look like this. And so you can see by just scanning that table that about 7 out of 10, there is some level of policy relationship in the comp plan to what they've suggested. And in many cases, there is a version of what they've suggested in the emerging code that's at the draft stage. It's not all exactly, and there are some things that we've said we don't think we can do, and so I wanted to walk through a couple things. One was improving neighborhood contact and early notification systems. It's a recurring theme. We don't currently have a project scope to do that, but we think we should, and so we've listed that as a follow-up project that we think ought to be on our work plan, and it's listed. Right. So, Susan, just to back up a second, Susan mentioned earlier that we would walk through the different stages that things are in. So the way this table is structured is that, in terms of those bins that she mentioned, the first column is, have we addressed it in policy? The second column is there an expression of that issue on the zoning or on the comp plan map? The third is there something related to it coming later in the code bundle you'll see? And so for the most part, there's a lot of yeses in policy. We have general policy that supports the notions raised in the initiative in most cases. Some of those ideas don't really relate to the map. They're more code issues, so I've got an NA on a couple of those columns. And then what I'm talking about now is just to give you a preview of what's in the pipeline for the codes that are following up. I mentioned that one issue that's not directly addressed yet but should be is the early notification and improving that. The second one down there, close the residential FAR gap. That's an issue where currently residential projects are not subject to floor area standards, and so there's a great deal of uncertainty as to the massing of new buildings that happen in the mixed-use zones today because they don't have to follow the floor area ratios. It's essentially free floor area, and that dates back to the time when we were trying desperately to incent any mixed-use development, and that's clearly not our problem anymore. And so the new mixed-use code does have a floor area ratio, and then the neighborhoods support that. They would like it to happen sooner. There isn't any legislative process that would get it to arrive sooner than the one it's already on. The third one there is improving compatibility with neighborhoods, and there's three elements to our response there. We are doing the design review assessment work. We are proposing to expand the design overlay with the mixed-use projects to cover more territory, particularly inner-southeast. And then in 2017, intend to get to updating the design guidelines. So there's three tracks on that. We mentioned the missing middle was one element. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. There are incentives in the form of transfer development rights for historic properties. The next one at the bottom of that table was variation of heights, which I think was mentioned earlier, and is part of the mixed-use projects and the zoning map that you will see. It gets at some of that. Turning the page, incentives for community amenities. There are bonus provisions, which Joe will give you a briefing on later. Solar, we did do a pretty extensive solar analysis of the masses and heights that would be allowed by the emerging mixed-use zones. We did that, you know, universally across the templates of different types of buildings that would be allowed. We're not proposing to do a permit-by-permit requirement that each applicant do their own solar analysis because, frankly, it would look a lot like the one we just did, and also there under Oregon land use law, you need to have clear and objective standards for needed housing, and so it doesn't give you an opportunity to do anything with that analysis at the permit level. So we again support doing solar analysis. We just think the right place to do it is at the legislative level when we're passing the zoning code to begin with.
So let me just interrupt you for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Losing the solar access standards in the subdivision code is one of my great failures on the Planning Commission, one that I would love to correct at some point. Oh, is there any discussion about having something on solar access in building standards or subdivisions or in any way, shape, or form?
I think we have found it to be problematic implementing, and that's one of the reasons that it went away, is that the 9 times out of 10, there was some reason why it couldn't be applied, and so we struggled to do anything.
That was the rationale when we made it go away. As we start to depend more and more on solar and wind, this might be something to pass on to your successor, Mayor, or something that I think, and it would be nice to have something in the comprehensive plan policies to direct a future project to say that, yes, solar access is becoming increasingly important for gardening, for various
There are policies that have that statement.
If you can...
What we're discussing, I think, is more the strategy of implementation.
Right. Okay. If you could just highlight that next time you and I meet as far as what's in there for solar access, I'd really appreciate it.
The second to the last one, then, is light and air and privacy issues. We have are proposing to change the setback standards and the step-down standards with abutting lower-density residential. One thing we're not doing is proposing greater side setbacks to buffer one mixed-use building from another, and that's one difference of recommendations between what they've said and what our current draft is. And then the final one was the proposal that applicants for buildings be required to do more of a California-style impact analysis with their permit, and that's something that's sort of at odds with Oregon land use law and the way that our whole system works here, and so we don't recommend that. What our process usually is to do that kind of analysis at the planning stage, at the neighborhood scale, not permit by permit.
Yeah, this is one that I want to have further conversation, Steve, with you and with Peabot about. I think we need to be very explicit that this is Oregon, not California, and stop any drift towards requiring traffic studies for permitted development. It's crazy. I mean, there will be traffic. But let's break it to everyone. There will be traffic in a city that has 240,000 more people than we have today in the same street network. So to be requiring traffic studies for planned development is just putting people through an exercise.
Oh, I have to disagree, because that's how we get the required, the necessary improvements. If that is the development that breaks the system and creates an intersection that fails, that development is then required to put in the light.
But that's why we have STCs. Everybody's paying STCs based on their projected, on their actual impact on the system, based on the number of units or their square footage or whatever. So that's generating their STC revenue. If we need to raise our STC rates in order to collect more revenue, that's a legitimate choice for the council.
I think that's something that we should have some more in-depth discussion, particularly with the city attorneys and with Peabot about.
I agree.
Well, and it's different. Don't misunderstand me. It's different in a situation where somebody's asking for a comp plan amendment.
No.
I'm talking about permitted development. I've got a site at the corner of whatever and whatever, and it's zoned for a mixed-use building. It's going to be a four-story building with 3 stories of housing over commercial. We've known that since the color went onto the map. But I still have to do a traffic study to build that building?
For the headwaters on 26th and near Barber, they had to do that, and then they had to put in the light at 26th and Barber as part of the approval of the development. That's very routine, that PBOT requires improvements in relation to a permitted development.
Okay, well, I think...
Territory of the subject of your next work session with, and so you may want to revisit that with PBOT.
The anecdote that I heard yesterday that made me crazy on this subject was that they narrowly avoided being required to do a traffic study for the conversion of the strip club into the homeless shelter at 162nd and Stark. And wait a minute. One, there's going to be a lot less traffic. And two, it's simply a conversion of an existing use that's already permitted.
So I think that's a matter of how we implement that standard rather than doing away with the standard altogether.
Well, let's talk further about that again. I think we should take a comprehensive planned approach rather than a impact analysis approach under Oregon law.
If I can just add my 2 cents on that, having just been in California last week, read the papers, And one of the things that's been clearly articulated down there is the impact analysis required under California's Environmental Quality Act or whatever is not anything to do with environmental protection anymore. It has to do with killing affordable housing projects. So I'm not taking a position on the traffic impact, but I don't want to go down any kind of an alley that says we're going to be requiring environmental impact analysis project by project, because that assures nothing gets done.
To be clear, I'm not suggesting that I want to add anything in addition. I just think there's value in the current system where some projects have to do traffic analysis.
Let me come back for a second to the design guideline piece here, because one of the things that I guess I don't understand as well as I should, and Joe, can we put this on my boot camp, the list of my boot camp issues when you come in, is the understanding the difference between the look and the feel of, say, Division Street and North Williams. Now, they both have critics, but frankly, some of the new development on North Williams, to me, overwhelms the street, the sidewalk, the space, and it's just enormous. And one of the things about Division is smaller footprint, interesting differentiation of style and design, more humane scale. It's a more walkable area. And I'm trying to understand what the key differences are between those two approaches. And maybe there's some real simple guide point, but can you give us just a couple of high-level points that explain the difference in the approaches to both streets?
I believe they're the same width, right, Eric? Is that's part of how we are determining the scale.
Division is slightly narrower. I think the two differences are the parcels are much bigger on Williams than they are on Division. We often have a lot of full block, and some of the blocks are 600 feet long as opposed to 200. So that's one key difference, is just the parcelization, which we can't do anything about. And then the second difference is that Williams currently has EX zoning, which allows taller buildings than the CS zoning on Division.
That's actually a pretty significant difference, the lot sizes and the zoning.
And with the EX actually comes design review as well, but you're seeing the net impact of that whole package.
Yeah, Williams currently has design review, Division does not.
Are there points to discuss on this one? So more work to do on the impact analysis.
Yeah, I would encourage you to look at the specific policies in the bigger attachment, and if you have any policy refinement related to this, let us know.
Okay.
Moving then on to the middle housing topic, and I'll start with the definition.
Middle density.
Middle density. MDH. What we meant by that is multi-unit or cluster types of housing that are more single-family compatible. So it's not single-family development, but it's usually 2 to 3-story wood frame construction, not as big as the mixed-use buildings we just talked about on Division or Williams, but more flexible in terms of the types of buildings like duplexes or triplexes or small garden apartments, cottages that are not all currently allowed in single-family zones. The zones that currently allow that full range of what I just described are typically the R2, R1 zones, which in the memo that was attached to your packet, there's a memo from me titled Middle Housing Options. On the second or the third page, there's a map that shows the distribution of those middle density zones right now. We've come up with kind of five options to explore in terms of how you could make more land available or more options available for the development of this type of housing, should you wish to do that. One of those options involves looking at expanding the range of what you can build in single family, and that's being explored through the infill design project. But there are other options that we wanted to also describe at this comp plan level that are not necessarily within that scope of that project. And so I want to go through those different options that staff have explored. A caveat here is that not all of these options have been vetted at the local scale with the public. We've given you some study areas on a map to illustrate where this might play out, but we're not making a recommendation at this step that you immediately change the land use on any of those places. Of course, that would be your prerogative, but this is a discussion of getting direction at the broad level about which, if any, of these strategies appeals to you, and that will help us inform our projects as we go forward. Some of the reasons why, I think those of you who are interested in this topic know this already, but some of the reasons why we're interested in middle housing are also listed in this memo. Sorry, I lost the memo. Here we go. Some of it, and that's on the second page of the memo, in terms of it being less expensive, partly because it's wood frame construction and not concrete or steel. It's a little bit inherently less expensive to build. Home ownership, there are generally more home ownership opportunities when you have that lower scale, larger unit development, condos notwithstanding. It supports our access to complete neighborhoods by, it is a form of housing that could be used to get more density around our centers and corridors to create that critical mass to support retail. And finally, choice. There's a demand for a greater range of housing types. We have said that we have enough, numerically we have enough land use to supply all the needed housing, but a large portion of that is in mixed use and higher density housing. And so in the interest of choice, council may have an interest in expanding the supply at this scale, not because we couldn't house everyone in other types, but because we might want that choice from ranging from different family demographics to aging in place or just providing more options in neighborhoods. So that was the background. I want to go through the specific. Sorry, was there a question?
I just have a comment before we launch into this. I'm going to be very reluctant to do any of this until we fix the Airbnb problem, because if we're just creating boarding houses in all the neighborhoods where people are renting out fourplexes for overnight guests, that's not going to help any of these except potentially for home ownership. So that's something that I'm going to be working with Thomas Lanham and the Revenue Bureau on, but we should not do any of this until we have figured out how to get Airbnbs and other short-term rentals properly permitted and enforced on the permits, because otherwise we're just opening up every neighborhood to become a commercial zone.
So the five strategies, and I'll go through briefly one by one. The first strategy is you got some testimony from a number of folks pointing out that historically some of the innermost neighborhoods were zoned multifamily and they are not today. That occurred in 1980 when there was some substantial downzoning in the inner neighborhoods, and particularly the southeast Portland. Much of inner north and northwest has since been re-upzoned to higher density, but inner southeast has not had a community plan that made it all the way through the process since the 80s, and so it has not really had a zoning overhaul. You could direct us to look more carefully at the zoning in inner southeast Portland, and that's in particular the orange on the map behind Commissioner Saltzman are areas that are currently zoned single family in that area, but are developed with a mix of apartment houses and other densities. And so you could look at plan districts or other tools to customize the zoning in those areas to allow more flexibility while still trying to put better tools in place for historic preservation.
So, I think that's a really great option for Sunnyside, Kearns, and Buckman. I think it gets us past a lot of the issues that we heard in testimony at the public hearings about the current mix works really well and how could we continue to allow a mix in those neighborhoods.
I'm very excited about exploring all these options because I do think it's really important to give people these housing choices, and I'm particularly concerned in a city where it seems like single family houses are going to become prohibitively expensive for most people. I'm particularly concerned about giving families some place to live, particularly I think that the apartment buildings on the corridors might not provide family accommodations. I'm actually a little reluctant to, if we talk about allowing more of the kind of density that we see historically in areas like Buckman and say, well, why don't we change the zoning to reflect what already has been there? I'm a little sensitive to the criticism that you're basically saying you're telling the neighborhoods that have already absorbed a lot of density to do even more, whereas in Northeast, where there's none of that, you're letting them get away without absorbing any density. So I mean, I want to keep an eye on that